Welcome to the Jaws of Justice Radio. My name is Keith Brown Eel. Today's host, Jeff Humphield, talks with Eric Leonard West, president of the Kansas City School Board, about the report that shows improvement in the district's performance and challenges yet to be met. Later, the ACLU Minute and our calendar of events. Now, let's hear from Lee and Eric.
Yep, this is Jeff Humphield, and Lee Moore is supposed to be here, but I imagine the bus is running a little bit slow, and he hasn't quite gotten here yet, so I'm sitting in for him. And our guest today is Eric Leonard West, Kansas City, Missouri Public Schools School Board Chair. And we're going to talk a little bit about a report that came out earlier in, last year, about how the school district is actually doing better and getting closer, hopefully, to accreditation. Again, welcome to Jaws of Justice, Eric.
Good morning, and thank you.
Why don't you tell us about this report? Where did this, who did this report, and what does it actually tell us?
Every school district in the state of Missouri is graded by Missouri's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education. And they are the ones who put out the grade card, so to speak, and based on that grade card, determine school districts' accreditation or non-accreditation level. And so when they put out that grade card 2 years ago, it suggested that we were only meeting three of the 14 standards toward accreditation. In order to be provisionally accredited, you needed at least six, and to be fully accredited, you need nine. Last year, when they put out that same report card, what it showed is that the district had gained two more standards to meet five of the 14, but that we had actually grown in 10 of the 14, which actually puts us on pace next August to be meeting seven out of those 14 standards. What this means is that by next August, we project that we will be able to regain provisional accreditation, and that within two or three years thereafter, for the first time in decades, really, the district could be eligible for full accreditation.
Okay, we know that the legislature has been looking at the Kansas City, Missouri schools, and as has the Missouri Department of Education.
Yes.
Does this perhaps forestall any action by either of them, do you think?
Well, no wise man tries to predict what will happen to Jeff City from year to year. I think it is reasonable that the state legislature continue to focus on education and look at ways that legislatively education can be improved. In my conversations with our state legislators, my number one advocacy has been and will continue to be for support as it relates to early childhood education. And what we know from research and from experience on the ground with our scholars is that an overwhelming percentage of KCPS scholars show up in first grade already 2 years behind. That doesn't seem to make sense, and the first time I heard it, it sounded like educator mumbo-jumbo speak. But what actually happens is that we can evaluate what grade level children are on it's very early and have expectations about what it looks like for a child to be fully ready to start the first grade, which is when compulsory education in the state of Missouri begins. The extent to which those children come to us behind doesn't mean we can't get them educated, but it does mean it's a lot harder for those children to catch up and to be where they need to be quickly. If the state supported our growing efforts around pre-K, we could make sure those children are never behind to begin with. It makes it a lot easier to ensure that they're fully literate by the end of third grade and that they graduate on time.
All right. That brings up an issue, and I believe the funding for parents as teachers
project was cut dramatically in the last couple of years. I don't know whether it's been completely eliminated, but it's been cut back so much that it's pretty ineffective.
Correct.
Is that one of the things that brought students, you know, does bring students to first grade ready to go?
Obviously, parents are a child's first teacher, and so the extent to which parents are well-informed about what things they can be doing when their child is born and when they're one and when they're two and when they're three, that really make a difference in terms of that child's academic readiness. Some of these things are as basic as just reading to your children every day. But some of them are a little less obvious, like ensuring that your children see you reading for pleasure on a regular basis, and thereby socializing your child to understand that reading is something that we do for fun and for pleasure and not just for work and for learning. And so when parents as teachers was available, absolutely, we saw a difference it would make in terms of first grade readiness. This is an issue that as a community we're going to have to tackle. Because if our children are not ready for school, it places a huge burden on first grade teachers to try to catch children up who are still functioning at a 3- and 4-year-old level. That's not fair to teachers, and it's not in the best interest of our scholars. As a community, we can do better, and we're going to have to figure that out.
Okay. You know, there are programs, like I said, the Parents as Teachers programs. You know, that program included an aspect that was a little bit more than just teaching children also, though. It has some of the social aspects. Mm-hmm. It goes into the homes and helps people that may need other social or be eligible for other programs mm-hmm. and stuff. You know, those poverty issues and those other type issues like that, what kind of impact is that having on the students coming into the Kansas City, Missouri public schools?
It's huge, but it's important to distinguish that while there certainly in the data exists a correlation between low-income families and lower levels of achievement, I would be very quick to point out to people that I do not see poverty as a causal, rather merely as a correlating factor. And so being poor doesn't mean you're going to do poorly in school. That's absurd. The overwhelming majority of our scholars come from low-income homes. We're more than 85% free and reduced lunch. But we have so many of them who go on to do great things. But yes, a lot of the circumstances that children face in low-income homes certainly makes it harder for them to achieve. So, for example, we talk about reading books to your children seeing you read. Lower-income homes where there's more financial pressures, you know, it's harder to have a full library of books at the home. That means you'd have to put more time and energy into taking your children to the library on a regular basis and trying to do a better job than I do of dodging library fines. And so it's not that it's impossible, but it certainly does make it harder on families. And parents as teachers and other programs like it, you know, help in very instrumental ways. If our legislature would be willing to help refund that, but then also to be expansive and create a line of funding for pre-K in public districts, it'd make a real difference for our families.
You know, you mentioned the library, and I know that, I mean, I've seen you in the library a number of times. It seems like that's where we meet when we run into each other. You know, let's talk about libraries in the school buildings. Mm-hmm. You know, I know funding has been difficult for all government entities. Have you had to cut back on libraries, and what kind of effect does that have within the school itself?
We have a formula from the Missouri's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education that really dictates a lot of what our HR placement looks like. And so that formula says if you have X number of children, this is how many art teachers and this is how many librarians and so on and so forth. And so we follow that formula. And so there is a threshold beneath which, as a district, we won't go. We'll always have libraries in our schools, and we'll always have librarians, though certainly in taxing economic times, they get stretched more and more.
What kind of specific programs do, you know, librarians do? In other words, where do they play into, you have a child that's running mm-hmm. behind in reading or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, how does the librarian and the library within a school, you know, work with that child? Or is that a special class or you know?
Yeah, we have a variety of ways of handling this. And, you know, so I actually want to distinguish the types of interventions needed for different children involve different adults within the schools. So not only do we have librarians in all of our schools, in all of our elementary schools, we're also adding reading interventionists, people whose specialty and specialization, their certification, their passion is early literacy. And so they can go into classrooms and work with children who are farther behind, or they can pull out groups of children who need special attention as it relates to early literacy. Our vision, which I'm so proud of our mayor for joining us in, is to see all of our scholars fully literate on grade level by the end of third grade. We know if we can do that, that the graduation rate sees a bump because of that, and that disciplinary rates go down because of it. It's a real key factor. And so we've poured specific strategies and resources into this early literacy piece. And our reading interventionists are an example of that. Certainly our librarians play a role in that in terms of inspiring a love for reading and aspirations around their academic goals. But yeah, our librarians are not alone in our buildings. We have several different strategies that we use to reach children who are struggling in that regard.
All right. I want to remind everyone they are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio here on KKFI. My name is Jeff Humpfeld, and our guest today is Eric Leonard West, Kansas City Public Schools School Board Chair. Eric, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you see coming up in the future for the Kansas City, Missouri Public Schools? You know, what you got planned?
Well, there's a few confusing things. So one, I want to hammer out this accreditation thing because I know it's on a lot of people's minds. Two important things to know about that. One, the standards for accreditation are changing, so be prepared for that. The Missouri's Department of Elementary and Secondary Education is modifying how they score school districts. And so it's going from a 14-point system to a 140-point system. And so that's going to look a little bit different. And honestly, the rigor of that scoring process is increasing significantly to better reflect some of the national standards that are emerging. And so expect that and expect to hear a lot of conversation about that, and that could take up a whole nother show. Separate from that, though certainly related, it's important to remember that accreditation is a status that applies to districts, not a status that applies to children. So all of our scholars who graduate this year, their diplomas are perfectly valid. They'll go on to college and they'll continue to do great things. It's really a moral issue. You don't punish children for the shortcomings of adults. And so the diplomas are perfectly valid, regardless of the level of accreditation in the state of Missouri. Always has been. That'll likely always be the case. All of that being said, what happens next? What happens next is that Dr. Green projected last year that we would gain 2 points toward accreditation. And when August came around and the report card came out, sure enough, you know, he nailed it. He said we're going to gain 2 more points, and we gained 2 more points. This year he's projected that we're going to gain another 2 points, and gaining those 2 points will leave us eligible for provisional accreditation. Come August, when that report card comes out, all of our projections, all of our data so far indicate that he's right on the money, that we'll gain at least another 2 points and be eligible for provisional accreditation. So in August, when those test scores come out, that'll be not really a time to celebrate, but certainly a time to recognize that we are on a trajectory that 3 to 5 years from now is going to put this community in a place where our scholars really deserve for us to be. How we get there, some of the key initiatives, key strategies that you're going to hear us talking about, we're going to be talking about middle schools. We're going to be talking about pre-K. We're going to be talking about early literacy. And you're going to, over the next several months, see a variety of strategies and community dialogues aimed at those issues, because it's not something that the school district can or even should attempt to do in isolation. These really are community issues, and we'll make every effort to include the community in the dialogue prior to moving on these large topics. But those are some key levers that we'll be pulling that we think are going to make a real difference for us, not merely in August, but over the next 2 or 3 years as we make the push for full accreditation.
Right. That, you know, talking about getting out into the community, and that's one thing I will give you some kudos for. You stepped out there into the community and, you know, kind of brought the whole school board with you too, and said, you know, hey, you know, we got to talk to parents. We got to be involved. That takes us in some ways into the issue of security, which a lot of people have on their mind.
Certainly.
Because of what happened in Connecticut earlier this year, and this school year anyway. You know, what kind of security issues do you see within the school district? And also, you know, when one of these things happen, they bring in crisis counselors and stuff like that. But so many of our students see this on if not a daily, a weekly or a monthly basis, where someone in their family or someone in their neighborhood or someone close to them is murdered or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of impact does that have within the schools?
Yeah, so two key questions that I'm hearing you ask. One is relative to, you know, what are our strategies around the safety of our scholars? And then second is when tragedy occurs, whether it's in the community, which is where it most frequently occurs, but if it were to happen in a school, you know, what is our strategy, you know, for supporting our scholars through tragedy? First on the security issue, we are actually pretty far ahead of the curve in terms of some of the things that we do that I think more and more schools across the country are adopting. So, for example, you have to the doors in all of our schools are automatically locked at all times, and you have to be buzzed in. You can't just walk in off the street. There's a little camera, and you have to press the button, and they can see you and be admitted. We also have both district security as well as police officers at all of our high schools. And it's been a great partnership with the Kansas City Police Department. Those are basic level precautions that I think very quickly we'll see become commonly adopted amongst nearly every school district in the nation, because they are reasonably straightforward and simple, though certainly costly to implement. In addition to that, we have a full book of procedures for every conceivable thing, you know, from the zombie apocalypse on down, of exactly what our teachers do, you know, when calamity comes either to the community surrounding it, which is when those normally get enacted, or if something happens internally, you know, whether it's something as simple as, you know, a fire alarm. And so where we really need to grow is that we haven't made sure that that training is as ingrained and second nature in our staff as it could be. And so we're going to be more aggressive in that area. But the preparation, the precautions, all those do exist. And that's kind of our vision for safety. And in fact, other districts have contacted our superintendent and said, what all are you doing? And we're happy to share that. In terms of how do we support our scholars, because unfortunately the specter of violence is such a common aspect of so many of our scholars' lives out in their communities, and that's going to come in and it's going to have an impact. What we've done really on two fronts. On a day-to-day basis, we've added social workers to our schools. And so as the routine stresses of our scholars' lives get brought into the school, there's a place for them to go and someone for them to talk to who has the training, has the expertise. We have psychologists in addition to social workers at our schools. And so people who are trained in understanding, how do we, support these young people through calamity? In addition to that, when a tragedy particularly impacts a school, so for example, God willing, may it never occur, but unfortunately, each year, it seems at least one of our scholars is murdered out in their community. When those type of tragedies take place in the community, the superintendent will dispatch a full team of psychologists and social workers to the impacted school to really inundate that building with the type of support network that it needs. So as those young people are dealing with that, that they have someone to go to. Our belief is that not only is it the right thing to do academically, because we help maintain a stable, secure learning environment, it's just the right thing to do from a community perspective, to give these young people the resources they need to learn how to manage their sadness in a healthy manner.
Well, Eric, we want to thank you very much for coming in. This is Jeff Humfeld, and you are listening to Jaws of Justice Radio here on KKFI 90.1 FM, and we have been speaking with Eric Leonard West, Kansas City Public Schools School Board Chair. It's really great to have you come in, and we'd like to have you come in again and keep us up to date, because really, we'd rather see that our students are on the path to good citizenship rather than on a pipeline to jail, and that's really what we're trying to address with this show.
Well, you're absolutely correct. It will take this entire community, but if we dedicate ourselves to what's possible for the scholars in this community, this is a winnable fight. But it is one that's going to take everyone who lives, works, worships, or plays in the Kansas City Public Schools area to get personally invested in the lives of our scholars. But as we do that, as parents, as neighbors, as radio talk show hosts, this is doable. We can make this happen. We've got a long road to go, and Dr. Green is moving us there. We're moving in the right direction, but it's going to take all of us, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
And now we're going to go to the ACLU Minute.
The Supreme Court has spoken. When arrested, you have the right to remain silent. Sort of, kind of, maybe.
Hello, listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
The Supreme Court has just rewritten Miranda. Since the Miranda decision in 1966, the government, the prosecution, in order to use a defendant's words against him, has been obligated to show that a defendant who was in custody knowingly waived his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. That's no longer true. In a recent 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that when a person in custody remains silent through hours of interrogation, that just doesn't count as an attempt to remain silent. Rather, the police can keep going after the accused, questioning and interrogating and questioning and interrogating, unless the accused comes upon the magic words and utters them, "I want to invoke my right to remain silent." Without that, he's out of luck. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, author of the Four Justice Dissent, got it right when she said that the new decision overrules precedent, turns Miranda upside down, bodes poorly for the fundamental rights that Miranda has protected for going on half a century, and counterintuitively requires a suspect who wishes to remain silent to speak.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union. Become a card-carrying member at ACLU.org, because freedom can't defend itself.
You are invited to participate in a poverty simulation Saturday, January 12th from 9 a.m. to noon at Good Shepherd Community of Christ, 4341 Blue Ridge Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri. Facilitator Glenn Hughes of United Services will use role-playing to give an understanding of the health care, food insecurity, transportation challenges, and other hurdles that families living in poverty face day to day. Please register ahead of time by contacting Diane Kaiser at 816-812-9313 or email her at mead8r@sbcglobal.net. The 6th Annual Kansas City Urban Summit will be held Saturday, January 12th at Penn Valley Community College, 31 and Southwest Traffic Way, Kansas City, Missouri. This year's Urban Summit will have three workshop tracks: the Healthcare Cell Workshop, the Crime Cell Workshop, and the Power of Learning to Read, Reading to Learn Through Community Partnerships. You can find out more information and register for the Urban Summit at www.kcurbansummit.com or call Reverend Keith Brown at 816-604-0618. That's the Reverend Keith Brown, not the Keith Brown ear here at KKFI. The United Department of Health and Human Services is hosting a series of community ambassador trainings on the Affordable Health Care Act, Obamacare. Three sessions are presently scheduled: January 8th at Maplewood Baptist Church, 10505 East Winter Road, Independence, Missouri, 64052, and February 8th at Maplewood College, Tri-Community Health Services Center, 3100 Northeast 83rd Street, Kansas City, Missouri. And finally, February 15th at the Kansas City Freedom School, 2200 Olive, Kansas City, Missouri. All sessions are 10 a.m. to noon, and class size is limited. If you want to register or your church or group would like to host a session, contact Alice Kitchen, 816-753-4424, or email akitchen1@kc.rr.com, or Sarah Starnes, 816-522-5584. Email starwall@aol.com. You can find these announcements and more at our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/Jaws of Justice Radio.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff or volunteers. If you have comments or questions, check out the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. You can join the Jaws of Justice Radio group by emailing us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. My name is Jeff Humfeld. We thank our engineer, Mike Murphy, host of the Wednesday Morning Buzz. Listen in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder. Attorney Mara Verhaden Hilliard of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund on the FBI suppression of the Occupy movement, and attorney and author Carl Mayer on the National Defense Authorization Act. Making Contact Thursday at 9:30 a.m. features Climbing Poetry. This performance duo talks about poetry, politics, and inspiration. Up next is Counterspin. Local filmmaker Kevin McKinney talks about his film Corporate FM, followed at 10 o'clock by Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hogue. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m.
The Kansas City 100,000 Homes Campaign will conduct a registry week January 30th through February 1st, 2013. This three-day effort will identify the most vulnerable homeless individuals in Jackson County. Volunteers are needed to make sure all homeless get counted. Interested volunteers should fill out the online form at marc.org/community/htf/100khomes.htm. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Tune in to the next EcoRadio KC, Monday, January 7th at 6 p.m., when host Steve Mann will interview Shannon Hayes, author and organic farmer, about how she is reclaiming domesticity from consumer culture. EcoRadio KC.